to do some breathing meditation, because when you watch the respiration, the breathing, it has a very special quality that allows you to easily let go, relatively easily, let go of random thoughts that are coming into your mind, like your thoughts and coming over here, the bus, and you know, what are you going to have for lunch, and what are you going to do tomorrow, and maybe worries, and you know, various things that we think about. So we focus on the breathing as the breath is coming in, without controlling it. And that's sometimes, for some of us, that's a little bit difficult. You feel like you have to do something. It's just watching the breath. Watching when it goes in. And then just as it's turning direction, going out, and so forth. And being satisfied with that, rather than you might think the richness of your thoughts. Other things might be more interesting, some attractive person that you've met or some nice thought or something like that. Sometimes focusing on something very, very simple like this, very austere, allows you deeper insight. So just watching the breathing and letting go of the thoughts. If other thoughts come in, let them go, and then we'll proceed from there. So sit comfortably and begin letting go of your thoughts by watching your breathing. Let go of your sense of the body also, because that's being apprehended and held with your conceptual mind. Recognize when you're breathing in and when you're breathing out. mind is a little bit calm, let go of your attention to the breathing and investigate the mind itself. Watch the mind. As though one corner of your mind is watching what is happening in the rest of the mind. There may be some other thoughts still coming up, some appearance of yourself or your body or some conversation going on. Recognize those thoughts as transitory, sort of arising within the spaciousness of your mind, and turn your attention away from the objective thoughts, because in a sense they are the objects of your subjective mind. Turn your attention away from the objective thoughts to the subjective mind, as though you were to turn your head around, look back at the perceiver rather than that which is being perceived. Has no shape or color, no solidity, but it does have a quality of being appearing spacious and clear. Beyond the temporary contents that come up, sometimes pleasant thoughts, unpleasant thoughts, angry thoughts, thoughts of attachment, depressive thoughts, whatever the contents of the mind, those contents are temporary, but the mind's nature of being this spacious, clear light nature endures through all of those. The mind does not obstruct thoughts from coming. It doesn't hold them within itself like some thick, viscous fluid, like molasses or something that you're difficult to get. If something falls into it, it's difficult to extract it. Mind's completely unobstructive. So we can, recognizing that, we can get confidence that we can eliminate the faulty states of mind. Distorted states of mind. They are not part and parcel of our consciousness. And likewise, watching the spaciousness of the mind, you can develop confidence that you can create within the mind wonderful thoughts, happy thoughts, virtuous, noble states of mind that we have only dreamt about till now, or we have thought we were not capable of developing. So see if you can do that within this quietness of the mind, thinking that from, at least for this period, the next 2 hours as we're listening to some talk about the Dharma. Maybe today, even beyond today, I'm going to try to act not simply for the benefit of the moment, for my own ego gratification. From my own point of view, I'm going to try to work to heal myself, to develop all of my positive inner qualities. Fighting the temptation to fall back into ordinary, mean, common, vulgar thoughts, and trying to develop noble thoughts to work for not only myself, but for others, to eventually be able to identify with the plight of others to such a degree that we instinctively place ourselves in their shoes and work for their benefits, what they need. It's not only possible, it's the most positive state of mind that you can develop. So within this quiet state of mind, think like this. I'm going to participate this morning. I'm going to listen, contemplate what's being said, come up with my own doubts if necessary, clarify them with the speaker if the time permits. But I'm going to listen with an open mind, with the intention not of simply amassing some new information that I can display at a cocktail party or at the coffee shop or with my friends, but to really heal myself. And after being healed, to develop all of my good qualities. I'm going to listen to the words being spoken as though they were medicine, with an open mind, with a childlike mind, even if I've heard the words before, thinking of them anew for the welfare of all beings. Your attention back to the present. So, anyone have any question or observation about the meditation we're doing? Anything you'd like to ask or add or subtract? How was your meditation? Yeah. No, this lady? Yeah. Was okay? Okay. Anyone have a bad meditation? Be honest. Might have had a busy morning. Huh? Everyone had a good meditation? Oh, okay. Impressed. Okay. So the topic of today is what's called the Four Seals. This doesn't refer to the Four Seals at the Singapore Zoo. I'm just teasing. The Four Seals. A seal is something that is used to authenticize something, right? If you have a document here in the city, you need to have it authenticized. Sometimes you need to get a notary or a certain stamp or something on it that that verifies that this is your birth certificate or your driver's license, whatever it is. So there are four particular topics that are that specify that a teaching is actually the Buddhist teaching, that certify if you can find within this teaching anything that contradicts these four seals, you would say that it doesn't qualify to be a Buddhist teaching. You can't say that any particular teaching will teach all four of these topics, any Buddhist teaching. It might specify on one, but it will infer all of these four. Okay, so I'll just mention briefly what they are, and then we'll go into slowly over the morning and the afternoon, we'll go over the details of them. Have you heard before the four seals? Have you heard? You have, but you haven't. Some. So there are different enumerations. If you study with some of the Theravada teachers, in some of the Theravada traditions, not all, they're enumerated with slightly different words, almost the same, and we'll mention about this later. So from the Mahayana point of view, the first seal is that all compounded phenomena are what? No, impermanent. Impermanent. All compounded phenomena are permanent. Compounded phenomena means, does that sound too complicated? We could use simpler words. We could say things instead of phenomena that arise from causes and conditions are by their very nature changing moment by moment. That's anything that has parts, for instance, that has come about because of causes and conditions, you know, mugs and cars and your body and your life and your mind, your relationships, all of them are by their very nature changing moment by moment. They are impermanent. Okay, this is the first seal. Then, the one you were thinking about, all contaminated phenomena are suffering. Contaminated phenomena. So you might say, well, yeah, I don't want to buy contaminated food in the market. You have an idea what contaminated means, right? Like in an ordinary sense, if you were to go to the market and you don't want to buy that food, it's tainted, it's got some... It's been, some garbage has been spilled on it, or it was exposed to some pesticide or something like that, contaminated. So what does it mean by contaminated phenomena? This is a particular understanding from the Buddhist point of view, having to do with how this phenomena has arisen. If it has arisen because of contaminated karma. And contaminated karma means karma that we've created in the past due to our ego, due to anger, attachment, ignorance, jealousy, pride, and so forth. When those kinds of phenomena are experienced in the future, by their very nature, they are unsatisfactory. They're not, let's say, for instance, this body, my body, I don't know about yours, my body has arisen because of my past actions in previous lives that were still, even they may have been virtuous to be born as a human, virtuous actions, good actions, they were still contaminated with a conception of myself as a real findable entity. You know, grasping to a self of persons. So they're contaminated that way. So this body is by its very nature something that will not bring real pleasure. Let's say, for instance, if we were to be attracted to another person and we're trying to practice the Dharma and this is becoming an obstacle, to recognize, even if we had the full attention of that person, their companionship and so forth, that wouldn't lead us, that the contact with them, their body, their personality and so forth, would not lead us to real happiness, because that phenomena is a contaminated phenomena. Don't tell your boyfriend or girlfriend that. You say, excuse me, I'm having nothing more to do with you. You are contaminated. Maybe it's something along the line where you can still, bodhisattvas, our lamas and so forth, we have compassion for sentient beings, but without the expectation that relationship with them will bring our ultimate happiness, because they are of the nature of suffering. Okay? And we'll go in a little more detail about that. So all compounded things, all things that are compounded. What's another one? When you make medicine, how do you say you make, what do you do to the medicine? You don't say you compound it. What do you say? You say, if you go to the Chinese pharmacy and they put different things together, and what is that process called? Concoction. Concocting. Yeah. Anything that's concocted from causes and conditions or compounded is necessarily impermanent. Anything which is contaminated, in other words, that has come about because of contaminated karma, is necessarily suffering or unsatisfactory. The third seal is now covering all phenomena, not just compounded or contaminated phenomena. All phenomena are empty and selfless. Empty and selfless. So that has various meanings in the different philosophical schools, but basically it means what many of you were here yesterday when we talked a little bit about selflessness and emptiness, began to present that topic. So everything that we experience, not only our own ego identity, I should start with that, the ego identity. The ego identity that appears to us so real, say if someone were to point out a fault in you and you say, they're pointing at me, the ego rises very strongly. That that particular thing that our mind apprehends, that we call the self, doesn't exist the way that it appears to our mind. The way that it appears to our mind is that there is really something there, solid, findable, a self. At first glance, you don't investigate what that means. You might associate it with your body. If someone were to compliment your looks or to criticize your appearance, oh, you've put on some weight, or oh, you're looking great, or oh, you look great today. You might associate with the body. If someone were to comment on your mind, or somehow you were to think about, something that you've done, I'm so stupid, you may associate the sense of self with the mind. But in the end, If you're trying to find what this I is, this soul or self is, after a long time of watching and searching, letting the mind calm, there seems to be a sense of the self that is rising almost independent of the body and mind, as though it were the controller of the body and mind, the experiencer of the body and mind. Somehow roughly related, but somehow different, but still as though concrete and as though it should be findable, something real, true, something true. One of the, when we talk about the word emptiness, we talk about the emptiness of true existence. So although this self appears to our mind to be true, and there, it also appears many other things, it appears to be somehow existing, not simply named, it seems to be existing from its own side, as though it's out there, findable, or in here, findable. The Buddha's revelation and what all of the great beings, yogis and yoginis, scholars and practitioners since then, the way that they've made these deep realizations is by recognizing, first of all, identifying how that self appears to us, and then through perfect logic, analysis, recognizing that it does not exist the way that it appears, and using the examples, some of the examples that we gave yesterday, like the fact that sometimes a reflection can appear to be something, but it is devoid of what it appears to be, right? Like the reflection of yourself in the door of the big Hilton Hotel. You know, you see your reflection out of the side of your eye, and you think there's someone over there, and you look, and you were completely fooled. It appears to be one thing, but is empty of that. Well, even looking in the mirror, we know generally that's not our face in the mirror, right? Our face is here, not there in the mirror. But sometimes beings are fooled by that. Another example, rainbow. Sometimes rainbow looks like it's out there somewhere, right? So where's that rainbow? Oh, it's ending on that island. What's the island that the amusement park is on here in Singapore? Sentosa. Yeah, so, oh, the rainbow is ending on Sentosa. If you go to Sentosa, you don't see the rainbow ending there. It's due to the light being refracted by the moisture in the air, right? You know, when there's a little bit of after the rains or something like that. So although a rainbow appears to be somehow findable, even if you get close to it, there's nothing there. It's not as though you can get there and it's right here and you can put your fingers through it. You can't, it's not even like that. It's always off somewhere. So this sense of self, the reason for giving these examples is that the sense of the self seems so tangible and real, so compelling, that at first we need to have some examples in our own lifetime of things that also appear so tangible and compelling, but do not exist in the way that they appear. Okay, so we talked a little bit about this yesterday. So the self, although there is a self that exists, it is much different than the way that the self appears to our mind. The self, you know, when you when you investigate for who you are, the self, that tangibility, that findability of the self seems to be something there. Whereas the way that we actually exist, conventionally, relatively, is something completely more rainbow-like. Simply the name, the concept given to our body and mind. Is there someone named Derek here? Is that a common name in Singapore? I was just thinking of the name Derek. So say Derek. And if Derek was his imagination here, there's a Derek sitting right here. So Derek might think in his mind that there is a real Derek somehow who's the owner of his body and mind, tangible, findable Derek. But the only Derek that conventionally exists is the Derek that we can, by common consensus, agree, oh, this is Derek. Derek is the person who has that particular body, has a little dimple on his cheek, his lip is this way, he drives this kind of car, or he's married to this person, or whatever. We can identify that particular body and mind as Derek, but if you look within the body and mind, you can't find what you might intuitively think is there. There's a real Derek, a real essence of Derek. There's nothing there. Derek is just a concept given to the body and mind. And on that level, that's the only way that Derek exists. That's the only way a person exists. So although there is a person, let's call him Derek, he is empty of the sense of a tangible person somehow existing within his body and mind. That's the sense of selflessness or emptiness of the self. So in this third seal, we said all phenomena, all things are empty are empty and selfless. Even the Buddha is empty. The Buddha, say for instance, let me ask, is the Buddha impermanent? Yes, Buddha is impermanent. Okay, what about the Buddha's, because she's an older student, I can see if I can catch her. What about the Buddha's nature body, the svabhavikakaya? That's the emptiness of the Buddha's mind, right? Is that impermanent? That's permanent. But you said Buddha was impermanent. Yeah, generally when we say Buddha, we don't refer to the emptiness of the Buddha. You're right, so we refer to either the Dharmakaya, which is impermanent, the omniscient mind, or the form bodies. So the Buddha is impermanent. Is the Buddha suffering, contaminated? Is the Buddha contaminated phenomena? No. According to Mahayana, Buddha is not contaminated phenomena because his body and mind have arisen because of uncontaminated karma, not contaminated by ego, by self-grasping, is evolved because of the collection of merit and wisdom over a long period of time. So is the Buddha empty? The Buddha, everything is empty. Even emptiness itself is empty. So you might say, oh, that kind of devalues if the Buddha is empty. Who wants the Buddha? You know, you have to realize what empty means. It doesn't mean that it's empty of some good qualities. Do you ever use that expression colloquially to say, oh, that person is very empty. They don't have any deep qualities. Vapid. That's not the sense of emptiness here. Emptiness is denying something which is not really there, but appears to be there. So to have the wisdom of emptiness is a very valuable, very constructive state of mind to have, because it sees things as they really are. It sees that all phenomena are empty of existing from their own side as though they could be findable. The ramifications of emptiness are very difficult to grasp at the beginning. And it is said that it can be it can be dangerous to make assumptions about emptiness, to kind of play around with it, thinking that you understand, in the same sense that without having skill, picking up a snake, if you pick up the snake from, let's say, the tail, poisonous snake, the snake may, the head may come around and bite you, right? You have to be very skillful to know what to do. You have to, maybe, I'm not expert in snakes, but yeah, maybe you have to grab near the head, you know, by the neck, if you call that the neck, I don't know how much the neck is, so that it can't bite you. So it's said that emptiness also has to be approached gradually, not to make, don't make a lot of assumptions right from the beginning. Just try to get a general idea at first, and then as time goes on, to refine that understanding of emptiness. Okay? So, all compounded phenomena are impermanent. All contaminated phenomena are suffering. All phenomena are empty and selfless. And the fourth seal is nirvana is bliss. Have you heard that before? Nirvana is bliss. So, or let's say the highest kind of contentment that you can have. What does nirvana mean? I mentioned yesterday a little bit. Generally, nirvana means a state in which we have eliminated all of the causes of our samsaric existence, our contaminated karma, our delusions. A person who's achieved nirvana is called an arhat. The Tibetan word for arhat is dachomba, someone who has destroyed the foes, the enemies of the delusions. Sort of a conqueror of that sense. So, at first glance, attachment, I no longer have durian ice cream. I no longer have my, you know, was it a pass card to the Singapore Swim Club or the golf club? Or you might think that nirvana would be suffering, you know, if you were to get rid of all of your attachment. But, and you might think that simply if you were in a state of nirvana, if you were an arhat, if you were to place before the arhat a nice vessel of some delicious liquid, nice Chinese tea, they would just sit there like, how could that be bliss? Well, when you're, it's not simply the kind of blah state. Say, for instance, when you're not energized by attachment, you're not energized by anger, you're just sort of like, blah. Your mind is dull, not seeing reality. Nirvana is not like that. Nirvana is a state in which all of the delusions have been eliminated from the mind, and one's mind is very, very content. It's the ultimate contentment. It's the ultimate bliss. Anything, all of the other things that we strive for in life, status, to be loved, power, the pleasure of the senses, so forth, All of these things we may consider bringing us a certain amount of bliss or happiness, right? Right now, it's difficult to understand that these are not real bliss. You know, the pleasure of food, and sexual embrace, and praise, and success, and wealth, and going to the nice spa, having a nice bath, massage. It seems like that's real pleasure. But as we mentioned yesterday, all of those things are simply the exchanging of one suffering for another. Right now I've got a muscle. In the last couple of days I have a muscle cramp. So I was thinking, I have to find someone who can give me some massage. A shiatsu or some good Chinese deep massage. You know? And so if I were to go there, and at first the pain, suddenly the pain of that, of this shoulder, I can feel right now, starts to go down, I might think, oh, that's real pleasure. Oh, wow, that's real pleasure. But if the masseuse were to continue pounding on my body, it was, after a while, I would recognize it as suffering. The at first, the suffering of the massage is small compared to the suffering. In fact, generally, if you do get, what's the famous Thai massage? Is it shiatsu or is it Thai massage? Was it? I'm not sure what you said. Sometimes can be quite rough, right? But at first, because the pain that it's countering is so intense, the muscle tension is going down, you don't mind the pressure because the tension in your muscle is going up. But once that tension in the muscle goes down, you recognize the pressure of the massage as real pain. You've just exchanged one suffering for another. Right? Or when you, I think it's a contaminated phenomenon here. You take a sip of something which is delicious. And because of your attachment to it, you think that is the real source of pleasure that I've just experienced. All you've experienced right now is the diminishing of one kind of irritation. It might be the irritation of thirst. So you've satisfied a little bit your thirst. But somehow, often we don't drink liquid only to satisfy our thirst. We drink liquid for some additional pleasures, like some flavor, right? Some delicious flavor. So that also can be understood. There might be some chemical process that is taking place in our mouth, in our tongue, that if it were to continue, it would be irritating. But at first, it brings some pleasure to our tongue consciousness. I don't know. Coca-Cola, is that something you consider blissful in Singapore? Maybe not. What's something you consider... What's a good drink? Is it durian? Durian juice. Durian juice. Or one of my favorites, there's a kind of, it's not exactly ice cream, they call it frozen custard in the States. It's kind of ice cream. And it is, the one place in Wisconsin where they make it, it's so, you get a shake. And a milkshake, but it's so thick that the spoon, you have to eat it with a spoon. You can't drink it through the straw, you know. It's called concrete. That's what they call it. And sometimes when they put in some other, they put in some almonds and a little bit of chocolate flake or something. So, you know, you would think, that's so good. So if you begin to taste that, and out of attachment, you're thinking this is a real source of happiness, not recognizing you're only exchanging one suffering for another, you will overindulge often. And you eat too much, you drink too much, and you recognize afterwards some suffering, that it has changed into obvious suffering. Even if you stop short of that, you weren't finding real happiness. You were just finding relief. Like this. If you have a very bad toothache, another example like the pain of the you know, muscle and having the shiatsu. Say you have a toothache and it's really bothering you and someone gives you a good pain reliever tablet and you take that after 5-10 minutes, you start to, the pain of the toothache begins to go down and you say, oh, wow, I feel so good. Actually, do you feel extra specially good then? I mean, probably not. It's just that with respect to the pain that was there before, that pain has been reduced to such a point that you label that bliss. Actually, if you then thought, oh, let me give another one of those pain relievers, maybe two or three, and people do this, don't they? When they overdose on drugs and things like that, thinking that the first dose has brought them some, you know, has reduced some anxiety in their life, then if they take some more, they will even be more blissful. So to recognize this particular phenomena, that the ordinary things that we strive for in life, they do bring relief, and if you treat them in that way, that's a skillful way to treat them, you know, relationships with others, the amount of money you have, just enough good. You don't need, sometimes more money causes more problems and doesn't bring real pleasure. Okay? Status, possessions, and so forth, all of these things we invest in our minds, we imagine them to be the source of pleasure. So out of attachment, we're striving for them and we waste the incredible opportunity of this life, what we could be doing with this life, finding these icky-picky, I couldn't say it right because of my throat, icky-picky. Do you know what that means? Real small. Do you have an expression like that here? Icky-picky. Some of them really small, trivial kind of happiness. What? You're thinking of trying to find some word. So we waste our lives not striving for those things that will bring the real bliss, like nirvana. We don't strive for nirvana. Nirvana is the actual state of bliss. Nirvana's bliss is not something that if you experience that longer, that it diminishes or it changes into suffering. Nirvana is actual bliss, whereas durian is not. Or concrete milkshake is not. Coca-Cola, chocolate, whatever. Okay? So that's just first go through, just to introduce the names of these four seals. So there are, if you were to check other doctrines, if you were to read the Bible, or you were to read the Quran or the Bhagavad Gita or other the Vedas or something. They may have great truths within them, but you can find often within them statements that contradict these four seals, so they would not be considered to be accurate portrayals of the Buddhist doctrine. Right? Something that can be certified as Buddhist doctrine, say for instance, would have to be something that did not contradict the doctrine of emptiness, that all phenomena are empty. Whereas in the Christian Bible, it talks, there's an understanding of the soul as being real, you know? So that would also, I think in all of the Abrahamic religions. So I'm not saying that that doesn't have some efficacy in their own practice, in the practice of those religions. I'm just saying, you would not consider then teachings that taught that taught that the self and the soul was eternal and real. That such a doctrine would not be capable of teaching you properly the Buddhist doctrine. That could not be sealed. That's not something that would be qualified to teach you about Buddhism. Okay. So, going back to the first one, all compounded phenomena are impermanent. So what does impermanent mean? We have a general idea. Impermanent means something that doesn't last, right? It may disintegrate, it may change. In general, from a Buddhist perspective, there are two levels of impermanence. There's what we call gross impermanence and subtle impermanence. Coarse impermanence and subtle impermanence. Gross, coarse, subtle. So it's important to differentiate between these. Gross impermanence is something that we can perceive with our senses, with our eyes, say, for instance, when we notice that the ice sculpture that was brought for our child's birthday party is melting in the sun. I don't know if you have ice sculptures. Do you ever have that for a birthday party or some kind of party? They make some sculpture out of ice. So if it's on the mantle, it's out in the yard there, and the sun is shining, and you can, over minutes, you can start to see it melting. Okay, that's an example of gross impermanence. Or if you were walking on the shore and part of the cliff above you falls off, that's an example of gross impermanence. We see gross. Anyway, say, for instance, cars have an accident. They're damaged. Before, the car looked pristine and nice and shiny and no dents. Now it's bent. That's an example of this change that we call gross impermanence. Gross impermanence. Because gross impermanence, not all the things that are taking place are examples of gross impermanence. Everything about us is changing. I was trying to look around to see if there are any other. If my hair were to grow out, I do have hair. You might think sometimes people, they say, "Oh, you're bald." Actually, I have hair, but I just, because the Buddhists shave their hair. Right? If my hair were to grow out, my hair would be gray, like my eyebrows are gray, right? So I was trying to see. There's only one other gentleman I see with gray hair out there. Maybe there's someone else. So when we were young, if we were to be given a photograph of ourselves now, we would see the distinction. There would be some gross change that we would notice. But because that has taken place slowly over the years, generally, unless sometimes you might have, your hair might change color very quickly if you have an illness. I think sometimes if you have, you come down with some very bad disease, you're in the hospital for something, maybe your hair turns gray in a very short time. Or if you have a trauma, sometimes your hair can turn gray very quickly. But generally, certain things take place so slowly that we don't notice them. But they're changing nonetheless. If you look at your face in the mirror, you don't notice it changing. But and even if you were to look at a photo of it yesterday or the day before, of course, maybe if you're a man, your beard will be different length. I don't mean that. I just mean the general contour of your face. But if you look over it over the course of 6 months or a year or 2 years, you would see that it has changed. And you can begin to understand it must have been changing moment by moment. So when we talk about subtle impermanence, it's the fact that all of the everything that we generally encounter that is made of parts, that is compounded because of causes and conditions, every moment, the next moment that something appears, it is always slightly changed from the previous moment. It is never exactly the same. Nothing continues along in an unaltered state. There are some things that are permanent. Now I'm going to throw you a loop here. What do you think? What do you know that is permanent? Because I said all compounded phenomena are impermanent. So there's a little hint there if you were to be logical. All uncompounded phenomena would be permanent. So what's an example of an uncompounded phenomena? What is something that doesn't change moment by moment, that the very next moment is exactly the same, never changes? Space, like outer space, which space do you mean? Outer space, like when we talk about going up with a rocket into outer space. That space doesn't change? I'm not sure. So when we talk about space, what's the Tibetan for space? Do you know the Tibetan word for space? Namka, right? Namka. So what's the Sanskrit word? Is that Indian lady that was here yesterday? She's not here again today. Akasha, I think Akasha is a word for space. So there's different kinds of space. There is the space that we see, like in between me and you, we would say, we sense there's some space. Something clear, and we can kind of infer that there's space there because, and not just a glass wall, because someone may walk by between us and they walk without any obstruction. We say, oh yeah, there's space. I see space. What we see is not the uncompounded space. So outer space, that's not the uncompounded space. Uncompounded space is something that you perceive with a mental consciousness, that you know it can correspond to this space, to the same area where that space is. Space is the absence of some obstruction, obstructing contact. Saying it that way, space is the absence of something. We're saying it as a negative phenomena. Space is the lack of obstructing contact. So I can infer that there's space here by moving my hand back and forth, and only say there's a certain amount of obstructing contact. You know, the wind, the air has a certain viscosity I can feel. But in general, I can infer then, I can't, you know, looking here, I might think I see that space, but that's not the actual space that's being explained here that is permanent. The lack of obstructing contact. Let's say this was a solid rock. And I can move this rock around because there's space around it. So there's no obstruction. I can move the rock, right? What about where the rock is right now? Here's the rock. Is there space in that? Is there space in that volume where the rock is, that location where the rock is? Is there space there? you might be tempted to say, well, no, because the rock is taking the space and you can't move anything through there, so there's no longer any space there, right? Would you think that, would that make sense? No? Oh, you say yeah. You say no. Why not? Oh, we have a good, we have a debate here. Okay. Pardon? Yeah, good. So his, that's his answer to you. So the very fact that the mug or the rock is here means that there is some space there, and it has not changed by moving the rock, the obstructing thing there, doesn't change the nature of space. Space is still unobstructing. If there were no space there, we wouldn't have been able to move the rock there. Or if suddenly the space changed, it was no longer space when the rock was there, that would contradict the rock being there, because the rock needs some space to be in. Okay, anyway, philosophical point. So there are some phenomena that are permanent. And I mention this because the first seal was that compounded phenomena are impermanent. Sometimes in the Theravada enumeration of the four seals, it said like this: all phenomena are impermanent. All phenomena are suffering. All phenomena are empty and selfless. Nirvana is bliss. So the first three for all phenomena. But the Buddha explained that not all phenomena are in, not everything is impermanent. There are some things that are permanent. More tasty rather than space, the ultimate nature of phenomena, emptiness, what we were talking about, shunyata, you know, selflessness, that is a phenomena which is also permanent. It doesn't change moment by moment. Emptiness is also permanent, like space. Nirvana is permanent when you've ceased the delusions so that they will never come back. That state is permanent, the state of being free of those delusions. What is called cessation. So when we talk about impermanence, we say that there are two kinds: gross impermanence and subtle impermanence. In order to realize, well, so let's say, very, very powerful realization to have, understanding to have, is the understanding or realization of impermanence. If you have a deep understanding, a realization of impermanence, my teacher Lama Yeshe used to say, it's like an atom bomb to destroy our problems, our unsubdued mind, our unhappiness. Ultimate atom bomb to blow up our delusions is the realization of emptiness, selflessness. Right? That's the true path that we talked about yesterday when we were talking about the truth of suffering, the truth of the causation of suffering, the truth of cessation, the truth of the path. Truth of the path was the realization of emptiness that will bring about the truth of suffering. So that's the real atom bomb that blows up the delusion so they never come again. But that's for us, most of us right now, that's somewhere off in the distance. That's not something we can utilize directly right now, the realization of emptiness. So while we are working toward that goal of realizing emptiness, we need to utilize this next most important antidote to the delusions, the realization of impermanence. So how do we go about realizing impermanence? So which impermanence are we talking about? Realization of subtle impermanence or realization of gross impermanence? What's the most important one? Subtle one, right? Subtle impermanence. So how are you going to do that? How are you going to realize subtle impermanence? This is changing moment by moment. Even you look at it, you know, you put eye drops in and you watch it, you don't notice it changing. Maybe in the laboratory with certain apparatus, you can perceive or you can get signals that the atoms are vibrating, right? The molecules you send through light, and it has certain indication that this is changing moment by moment. But we don't notice that with our senses generally. Here, the sense of subtle impermanence is even something more subtle than that you could measure in the laboratory, you know, the vibration of the atoms. Every moment something appears in the world, its occurrence the next moment has come about from the previous moment. It's always sort of unfolded, so to speak, sort of the previous cause was the previous moment of that phenomena. The present moment of George, this moment of George, has evolved from the previous moment of George. Slightly different, never exactly the same, but because it arises in such a similar appearance to the previous moment, we do not perceive that change. That's what's called subtle impermanence. How can we begin to realize that that is the nature of compounded things? Well, we first have to recognize and meditate on gross impermanence. And that doesn't mean just going and watching car crashes or cliffs falling or something like earthquakes or something like that. What it means is to the most beneficial meditation to realize gross impermanence. Do you know? I'm really testing you. The meditation on death. In fact, when we begin to study the stages of the path, one of the first meditations, besides after guru devotion and the preciousness and utility and rarity of this life of leisure and endowment, perfect human rebirth, the next thing we usually meditate on is death and impermanence. The reason is that we want to be able to realize subtle impermanence, but to realize subtle impermanence, we first have to realize gross impermanence. And the most beneficial example of gross impermanence, the most beneficial thing for our meditation, is to realize we ourselves have to undergo gross impermanence. We ourselves have to die. Probably none of us here were sitting here just a minute ago before we talked about this thinking with the thought in our mind, I'm going to die. Sometimes if someone had that thought all the time, you might think they're paranoid or what would you say? In need of psychiatric care. I'm going to die. But we are going to die. What's the utility of meditating on death? Well, again, from the point of view of the Four Seals, in terms of subtle impermanence, understanding, not just in a general, like someone said, if someone asks you, "Are you going to die?" There's this lady in the green shirt. What are you going to die? Someday. What do you think? No. No answer or no, you're not going to die? Yeah. But right. We would say, yeah, of course I'm going to die. But it doesn't really touch our heart, right? It's not something that we have realized. And so because of that, the trivial occurrences of this life become more irritating. The example that I give sometimes is like this. If we were to hear, someone were to come in, if the unknown were to come in and say, I just received report, the United States Air Force has sent a nuclear bomb by accident to Singapore, and it's going to arrive in 3 minutes. You know, and, I mean, it'd have to be the United States. At that point, I'm not going to say to one of you, hey, Jeffrey, you owe me $5. You know, all of the other kinds of trivial concerns of this lifetime sort of go to zero because we see the imminence of death. What we might do, if we have some faith, we might make prayers, we might make some prostrations in the last minute, or create some merit. I give you all my money. If we had an understanding, a realization of death, the inevitability of our own death, and the fact that it can come at any time, there's no certainty it's going to be sometime, you know, another 20 years, 30 years, 40 years, 10 years from now. It could be any time, it could be today. If we have a realization of this, our activities can change, and we will be using our time in the same way that a person who heard the atom bomb is coming in 3 minutes, you know, would not be wasting their time on trivial pursuits. It's said, Lama Zopa Rinpoche says sometimes, it says in the scriptures that if you meditate on the inevitability of death and that the time of death is impermanent, so I could die today. And every morning you wake up and you meditate on that and you think, today I may die. For many, many years you may be wrong, right? You may live through that day, and the next day you live here. But that day you practice Dharma because you thought, I may die today, no time to waste. But there will become a day when you're right. The person who wakes up thinking, I will not die today, you know, I may not die, I will not die today, they may be right for many, many years. But at a certain time when they die, they're wrong. And that's the most important thing. So although the person who thinks I may die today, they could be wrong, they may not die that day, they will eventually be right, and they profit, because every day that they think that, they're more careful about their behavior, because thinking, rather than getting angry, creating negative karma that I'll have to experience in the future, I'm going to have to die, doesn't matter. That kind of behavior is something that is more indicative of a saintly person. You know, someone who is actually practicing religion. You know, foregoing the anger and irritation with very simple things, having a calm mind also. So the meditation on death and impermanence has several overlapping benefits. It gets us closer to realizing subtle impermanence, which would be even more powerful if we recognize in our interactions with others, relationships and so forth, that this relationship is impermanent. Any kind of little irritation that we have or argument that we have, we understand in that context that this has changed, this can change. I think almost every time that I've come to ABC, I've told this one story. So if you've heard this story, if you've come to the talks before, you've heard this story before. When I was in, when I was a teacher in Beirut, Lebanon, in I think 1972, a friend of mine had been arrested by the police. He had had some harebrained scheme to be sending back contraband to the United States, and he'd been incarcerated in this prison in Beirut. And I went to see him after a day. He was a very good-looking guy, so he had been already, by this time, he had been physically, what's it called, molested by some of the other principals. You know, in the prison sometimes, not just out of anger, but out of attachment, maybe because he was attractive, there was some sexual, you know, kind of molestation also. So I came to see him. Outside in the courtyard, there were these bars. They brought the prisoners in. You could see them one at a time. And I came up and I said, "How are you? How are you doing?" And he said, "This too will pass." That's a phrase that we had ourselves read in the texts of some Sufi masters that we were reading at the time. You know, "This too will pass." This is a phrase that you find in a lot of literature that's talking about impermanence, right? If you have that understanding, even though my friend was undergoing this, not only being incarcerated, but being molested, tortured, or sexually molested, just to know that this will pass begins to calm the mind. You're not holding on to, even though you may not think, if you were asked, "Will this torture go on forever?" you might not say it will go on forever. There's an assumption in the mind that this is unending. So just to realize that, to understand that this will pass, is of, you know, something. It's like a Dharma realization. It's utilizing the Dharma as a refuge. We take refuge in the Dharma to alleviate our suffering, to protect us from suffering. So it helps to alleviate some of the states of mind that are causing problem. So how can we get familiar? How can we meditate on death and impermanence? Well, there are many methods. One, a very simple way, is just to imagine ourselves right now growing older into our, some of you are, who's the youngest person here? Anyone in their teens? No one's in their teens, are they? 20s? Any 20s? No, you're not 20. You put up your, I thought you were saying you were 20. You were 30s? Some people 30s? No, come on. Not all of you are over 30. Someone's in their 30s, right? Huh? 40s? Okay, I thought you were, no one was there. 50s? 60s? 70s? I'm in 73. 80s? Coming. So, imagine, you know, next year, growing a little bit older, and say even without an untimely death, say we have a natural death, we live another 10, 20, 30 years, some of you that are younger, old, maybe more years, but there will become a time when we get old, we're becoming frail, and let's say it's a natural death, it's not sickness that and so forth and so on, but we're becoming more weak. Our senses, first our eye senses, degenerate, just as many of us, that's usually the first of the senses that, even in the gross sense, distant sign of death. Sometimes in your 20s or 30s, you need to wear glasses, or younger, then our ears, our hearing begins to go, even our smell and taste, so that food no longer brings the pleasure that it once did. It's just like, blah. But that's not your case, because you still enjoy durian, right? You still smell the durian. I think even a person on the moment of death would smell durian here and think about it. So that may be the only exception. So you can imagine that and see that is something that's going to happen. And at that point, all of the possessions that I have, the money that I've accumulated in my savings, my bank, my possessions, my house, all of that has to be left behind. I can't take anything with me. This can help, although this is an ancillary topic, the fact you can't take it with you, is not immediately addressing impermanence. Still, it helps to understand the significance of impermanence. There's a famous expression in the Buddha's teachings that at the time of death, a beggar and a king leave exactly the same way. The beggar cannot take his or her begging bowl and staff. The king cannot take his crown or queens or, they leave exactly the same. The Tibetans used to, when they traveled, carry with them butter for their delicious Tibetan tea. Have you had Tibetan tea? If you have, you may not say it's delicious, but anyway, they like it. You've had Tibetan tea, right? Butter tea, yeah, yeah. I say Tibetan tea is always Tibetan butter tea, yeah. So they would carry the butter on the horses or the mules or the yaks from place to place in containers that were covered with leather, and sometimes when they would open that up and they take out some of the butter, there would be a yak hair, or the female of the yak, the dri. Let me ask you a question, just so you know something very worldly, not a Dharma realization. So what kind of butter do they put in Tibetan tea? Cow butter? Yak butter, right? She said yak butter. That's the famous animal, the big furry animal with the big horns. This is one of my teachers used to go like this. The yak is the male. So the female is called dri. So it's the butter in Tibetan is mar. So they say dri mar. When Westerners come and they say, can I have some yak butter? The Tibetans kind of laugh a little bit. It's like asking, can I have some bull milk or bull butter? The male of the cow doesn't produce milk or butter. So sometimes when they would find a hair in the butter and they would pull it out, and it would come out completely without bringing any butter with it. It would just slide out. And they say, like that, like taking the hair out of the drimar, out of the female yak butter, we leave this lifetime without taking anything with us. What we do take with us, the only thing we can take with us, are the karmic instincts that we've deposited on our continuum, on our mind stream, so to speak. The good and bad karma, that's what will go with us. Possessions, all of the things that we hold, ordinary, mundane people hold as most important, none of that can be taken with us. So to contemplate this like this, thinking that I will definitely die, and think of the things right now that are most, precious to you, your friendships, people that you love, your possessions, your status, your reputation, when you leave this lifetime, none of those come out. Like the hair from the butter, it doesn't take its reputation, the reputation of the butter or whatever. We leave alone. So that's one way of meditating on death. And that can be very, very powerful. And then you can also meditate on the stages of death. Generally, this is a topic that is related with the practice of Tantra also, because the meditators who do various tantric meditations try to induce the same experience that we have at the time of death through meditation. It doesn't mean that they're trying to die, but they're trying to bring, they say, at the time of death, the vital energy that courses through our body, the subtle energy that's called prana. Have you heard of that word, prana? The Tibetans say lung, or wind, the air energy. In acupuncture, Chinese acupuncture, what is this called? Qi, right? Qi? Qi, yeah, so qi. The qi, which acts as the support of our senses, begins to absorb back to the core of our body, to the center chakra of our body, the heart chakra, successively. In a normal death, in a death which is not induced by a sickness and so forth, it comes in a somewhat regular fashion. First, the chi, which supports the eye consciousness, begins to absorb, and certain kinds of mental faculties diminish. And there's a certain kind of subliminal vision at that point that one senses in the mental consciousness. You don't see it with your eye, or you don't hear it with your ear or anything. A certain kind of vision occurs, as though shimmering like a mirage-like vision. So the meditators, even though this will take place at the time of death, some meditators are able to actually induce that by their own yogic meditations, bringing the chi toward the heart chakra. And then they would see after that, and they would use that opportunity to meditate. That's happening, recognizing that they're going to die, that the next element is going to be the chi that supports the ear consciousness, which is a water element. And as that absorbs, there is a vision of smoke, like in a kitchen, a smoky kitchen, or in the temple when some incense sticks, you see some smoke slowly moving above that, the incense. You call it smoke? Incense smoke? Or incense? Is that the right word? Smoke? One uses also that to meditate, that opportunity. And if you were an advanced meditator, you use it to meditate on emptiness. Then as the nose consciousness absorbs, associated with the chi that supports the fire element, there's a vision of, again, not through your eyes, but in your mind, if your mind is not preoccupied by other things, like fear and so forth, the meditators who are doing this and can meditate at the time of death are looking forward to this process. They're not afraid. They're not worried about other things, losing their family and their possessions. They're just aware of this. There's an appearance of as though sparks after an anvil, after a piece of iron has been pounded on the anvil. Do you know what I mean? Sometimes sparks come up and this, or fireflies. I'm not sure what they're called in Singapore. We call in America fireflies, the little insects that give luminescence at night. What do you call? Glowworms? Glowworms, they fly? Glowworms fly? Sort of like that. And then one meditates that now the fire element is absorbing. I must meditate on emptiness. And then as the tongue and body consciousnesses absorb, which are associated with the air element, there's a vision of a, like a dying lamp or a dying candle. Not the flame, but if you were to say, you know, the Tibetan butter lamps, do we sometimes have on the altar here those butter lamps? Or maybe you have, sometimes you've seen temples where they have the clay bowl with some oil and a little wick. You're familiar with what I'm talking about? So when, just at the moment that is dying, there's a little effusion of light, sort of bluish glow of light that sort of indicates the end of that lamp is about to take place. Otherwise, it's been sort of a constant yellowish white light. But at the end, there's that light. So that kind of vision takes place as the chi that supports the air element absorbs. And the meditator would recognize this and remind themselves that they are nearing the actual death. They must meditate on emptiness. And then there would be successively, as the various elements of the body, an element from the crown begins to descend to the heart chakra, a white element they call white bindu. There is a vision to the mental consciousness then of a very spacious, not emptiness itself, but a kind of empty vision pervaded by a white vibration. Like when the moon is full, you're not looking at the moon, but you look at the rest of the space, there's some kind of whitish vibration in the space. A little bit like that. And recognizing that this is a very, very subtle mind now that must meditate on emptiness. Then the red element that abides at our navel chakra begins to rise, ascend to the heart chakra. And because of that, the vision now is a more subtle spaciousness pervaded by a copper reddish color, like the color of the sky. And some nights when the sun sets, there's kind of a reddish glow. What does they say? Red sky at night, mariner's delight. You know that? Red sky in the morning, mariner's warning. Maybe you have the different words, something like that. So that kind of glowish, that red kind of glow. Then finally, when the two drops meet at the heart, one is almost ready to be pronounced dead. There is a vision that's even more subtle than the white and red visions. No longer there's any vibration of white or red, but it's beginning to be more and more dark. They call it the dark vision, the dark near attainment, almost ready to attain the clear light of death. When all of the winds, all of the chi, all of the prana has absorbed to that heart chakra, at some time, the body within which that has been encapsulated, the white and red drops, separate, and the most subtle mind that we exist will manifest. At that point, all of the gross minds that we have now, our eye consciousness, ear, nose, taste, touch, our mental consciousness, our thinking, all of the gross consciousnesses are absorbed. They no longer are present, and only the core subtlemost mind that will continue from this life till the next is manifesting at that time before it leaves this body, before the next rebirth. And the meditators who are very proficient can actually observe that clear light mind, totally non-conceptual, no thoughts, like a vast space that is empty. And they can use their memory of the meaning of emptiness, remembering consciousness, to unify at that point. They say the unification of mother and son, meeting of mother and son. What is naturally occurring is like the mother-like clear light. It's not emptiness itself. It's the subtle most mind, but it appears as though it had no obstruction, is just totally clear. If they can recall, because of their constant meditation, that this is the meaning of emptiness, that there are no phenomena existing from their own sides. They are all empty like this. Of course, they wouldn't be using concepts. This is just a remembering consciousness. They can achieve the highest of Buddhist realizations at that point. They can have a direct, subtle realization of emptiness. They can use that death experience to enhance their practice rather than something like, oh, I'm going to die. They can actually look forward to that. So that's one way of meditating on death. You can generally think, just to the point that I'm on my deathbed, I have to leave all of this aside and then I will definitely die. Or you can go through the death process. That can leave a very strong imprint in the mind. But what became renowned in Tibetan Buddhism was a series of meditations on death called the nine-round meditation on death. Have you heard nine-round meditation? Who's? You've heard, right? Nine-round meditation on death? I'm really catching, really pressing her hair because she's a senior student here. Do you remember the nine-round meditation on death? So there's three main points. Death is definite. The time of death is indefinite. And at the time of death, nothing helps but the Dharma. And each of those has three points to help realize it. So 3 times 3 makes 9. So we'll talk about that after lunch, that meditation a little bit. Because it's that meditation. So how does that relate to our topic? So we're talking about the first of the 4 seals, right? All compounded phenomena are impermanent. So we said there's gross impermanence and subtle impermanence. The most powerful realization is that of subtle impermanence, but in order to realize subtle impermanence, you first have to realize gross impermanence. And one of the most powerful methods to realize gross impermanence is to meditate on the gross impermanence of our being, the inevitability of our death, to meditate on death. Would you agree that death is an example of gross impermanence? One moment you're alive, the next moment people would say, no, George is no longer there. George is dead. Actually, is that right? If I were to die, if I were to just suddenly conk out here right now, would it be correct to say that George is dead? There's a subtle point here. Why? Is it right? The body is dead. Okay. But George, I say, George is dead? Where is George now? George is not dead. George is some, what was previous, well, you could say, what I used to call George is dead. But the continuum of George is still alive. So, you know, the continuum of our mental consciousness never ceases, even to Buddhahood. So, there's a debate, the reason I mentioned that there's a debate in Buddhism about between the Theravada and the Mahayana. Is there some person who achieves final nirvana, arhatship? Okay, so the person who is seated in meditation, the last meditative, I say, is there someone who achieves nirvana without remainder, without the remainder of the aggregates? That means after you die, if you've achieved nirvana this lifetime, you're an arhat, and then you die, according to some Theravada interpretation, the mind snuffs out, like when you put out a lamp by putting some cap on it, you know, you snuff it out, or you have, and sometimes you turn out the candles, you have this little thing in the cathedrals, they, you know, you deprive them of oxygen, so they are, the light snuffs out. Some of the Theravada interpret the meaning of nirvana to be that, the snuffing out, so that no longer is there any consciousness and the person no longer exists. That's not the Mahayana interpretation at all. In fact, many of the other, not just the Theravada. Theravada is one of the Hinayana schools. Many of the other Hinayana schools said that that's not correct, that something continues. But say, under the assumption that the person no longer exists after that, who achieves nirvana without remainder? Without remainder means the state of being in nirvana, but no longer having connection with the body and mind. Well, the next instant, when you're dead, if there's no longer consciousness, there's no longer a person, so there's no one who has achieved that state of nirvana without remainder of the aggregates. Anyway, just leaving some seeds when you hear about these things in the future. Some of this may make no sense to you now. Someone mentioned to me yesterday that they were listening to, or the other day, they were listening to Geshe Trunie's teachings, Geshe Ken Rinpoche, who's now in Kopan, right? And they said, I don't understand anything he says. I don't know if she meant didn't understand his accent or the content, you know. I said, don't worry, because even you don't think you understand anything right now, you leave imprints in the mind. And having heard various things now, maybe next month, next year, when Lama Zopa teaches or Geshe Trunie teaches, and they're talking about nirvana without remainder or something, you'll perk up. Because you'd heard that word before, and now you'll fill in some details. It's always very, very useful to hear the teachings. So that's the connection, the meditation on death with this first seal that all compounded phenomena are impermanent. And I'll just reiterate before we do a dedication and then we take our break for lunch. So these four doctrines, you might say, are indicative of the Buddhist doctrine. If you were to find a text which contradicted any of these four so-called seals, you would have to say that text did not qualify to be encompassed within the Buddhist canon. Why is that important? Because it would not be reliable for your study of Buddhism. It might still be reliable for other things. It might be very valuable for your study of Christianity or Islam or the Vedic religions or Zoroastrianism or whatever. But it wouldn't be a valid text to use for Buddhism. So the four seals were all things that come about because of causes and conditions are impermanent. And within that regard, we mentioned that there are some things that are permanent. Not everything is impermanent. Sometimes in the Theravada tradition, they say all phenomena are impermanent. But that's not the case. There are some things that are permanent. All phenomena that have come about from the contaminated mind that's grasping to true existence and self-existence, we say contaminated. All contaminated phenomena are by nature, are necessarily unsatisfactory. They're suffering. All contaminated phenomena are suffering. So, if you sometimes you think, oh, I didn't get what I wanted. I didn't get that person's friendship. I didn't get the prize. I didn't get this. Something that would be very powerful if you remind to think, even if I had that, that contaminated phenomena, I wouldn't be happy. I wouldn't be really happy. It might bring me some temporary relief. And who knows how temporary. Sometimes it's so temporary. You know, you get something you really wanted and then it turns into the opposite. Then you have to be with that person, which you didn't realize had faults that you suddenly recognize. So all contaminated phenomena are suffering. All phenomena, everything, are empty and selfless. So it means our self, the outer phenomena. And that understanding of emptiness is something very, very, we have to approach gradually, but it's something that we can realize, we can get an understanding of this lifetime. Between the two, the realization of emptiness and the realization of bodhicitta. You've heard of bodhicitta? Some of you, maybe some of you have not heard. Which is more difficult to realize? Say loud. Louder. Bodhicitta, thank you. That's the right volume. I couldn't hear you. You were being very respectful, shy. So generally, yeah, sometimes you think it's bodhicitta is easier to realize, right? Oh, what did you say? It's more difficult to realize. Yeah, okay. So sometimes we might think that bodhicitta, because it's something we can understand conceptually, to have a mind, courageous mind, that is willing to work for the welfare of others out of compassion, to work for enlightenment, we can understand that conceptually. So we might think that's easier to realize than emptiness, which is difficult to understand conceptually, right? But the case is just as, what's your name? Felicia. Felicia, just as Felicia said, to actually actualize bodhicitta is very difficult. Whereas, although at first emptiness is difficult to conceptually get your mind about, when you've studied it with Geshe Trini, others, with Dalai Lama, Lama Zoba, as you begin to understand it, you can actually get actualize within your consciousness a realization of emptiness. Maybe not a direct realization, but a correct realization. And on the basis of that, if you are a person of sharp intellect, that can help you to enhance your bodhicitta. You know this, right? Because if you realize there's no self here, the self that I've always been cherishing more than others doesn't exist at all the way that my mind has been apprehending it. You can even develop the mind that begins to associate with the entirety of sentient beings rather than identifying only with this body and mind, if you have an understanding of emptiness. So, we're going to continue after our lunch break. Let's just take a couple of minutes to calm our mind again and to dedicate the virtuous energy, the virtuous karma that we've created this morning. So begin by watching your breathing. Let go of all the thoughts. Let go of your body. focus. Focus your attention. Then focus your attention on the mind itself, the subjective mind, rather than the objective thoughts. And think this is my potential. Within this mind, I can develop all of these understandings that we've talked about today, the realization of the four seals, emptiness, bodhicitta, renunciation, understanding of impermanence, the suffering nature of cyclic existence. How wonderful that would be if I could manifest those realizations within my mind. And I can. One of the cooperative conditions, one of the necessary conditions for that fundamental condition is to create the karma that I have done so today. I've created virtuous karma, listening to the very topics that I'd like to make realizations about. Due to these merits, in whatever way that they ripen in the future, may they become causes, the cooperative conditions for me to make these Dharma realizations, renunciation, impermanence, realization of bodhicitta and emptiness. As a result of that, may I practice the bodhisattva path and quickly become enlightened to solve all of my problems, to be totally blissful, like the meaning of nirvana. Nirvana is bliss. Enlightenment is bliss. But beyond that, beyond just our own benefit, to be able to spontaneously and effortlessly appear and lead sentient beings in whatever way, over whatever period of time is necessary, out of their suffering and into that safe state, that safe haven of enlightenment. Due to these merits, may I quickly become enlightened for the sake of all sentient beings. So good. We're just, according to that clock, we're just on time.